Okay, I'm going to welcome you and we will get started to why Christians should get behind the classical education movement. Yes. And as it's been interesting, as several of you have come up to me already and asked or mentioned that you were interested and that you already knew something about classical education. So I want to start off tell you who I am, a little bit about myself. I'm Miranda Parrish. I am the clinical coordinator for our student teachers at Welch College. So I go out and help them as they go into the school system, help prepare them. I'm also in the final year of working on my PhD from Faulkner University. It's in humanities, the degree I'm getting, but they do things based upon classical education. We go through the entire Great Books program. So that's really where I had most of my introduction into it. So before we get started, I want to find out a little bit about you. How many of you either, well, let's start this way. How many of you teach in a classical education setting? Several of you. Awesome. Y'all will end up being a great contribution to this because we want to hear from you as well. How many of you have a family member who either attends or is involved in some form of classical education? Several of you. Great. Wonderful. How many of you maybe have heard about classical education but don't really know anything about it? Okay. So we have a mix here of people, which is good. So we're going to start with the basic. What is it? What is classical education? I don't know why music appeared down there. but anyway, for some of you who aren't as familiar about it, somebody tell me what you think of when you hear the term classical education. What do you think it involves? What do you think it might be? Latin. All right, Latin. Somebody else? Old books. Traditional in style. Okay. For some of you that are involved in classical education, how would you add to what they have said? Okay, meeting the child where they are based on how the human brain works.
Teaching them how to learn rather than
just teaching facts. Anybody else? These are all great answers because they're all correct.
Is it a shift away from entrepreneurial education to student as customer?
Somewhat, because you're wanting them to be involved. They're not just the customer getting it. They are part of being involved to get it. But at the same time, you are working with them to help mold. So I guess you could argue that one a little bit either way. But traditionally, yes, you would not think of the child being the customer that is waiting to be served. You're wanting them to learn to think and work and be active.
Less emphasis on the STEM aspect, as in we're producing workers that can go out and do certain things.
Right, there tends to be a less emphasis on STEM, although I recently wrote a paper on how you can combine classical education and STEM, that they do work together.
Yeah, science and mathematics is part of it.
Yes. It's not as much of the hands-on. Right. It's less job focus. Let's get the foundational and basics so that they're able to learn anything for any job that they need. You're getting the foundational part. I guess it goes with what they call liberal arts education. Liberal in the sense that it is covering everything. You liberally are learning about knowledge. You're not generalized or specialized in one area. So let's look a little bit at it. Like we said, it is tools for learning through liberal arts. And they specify, they have fancy words for their liberal arts, because we are wanting tools for learning. It is not the only way to learn. And they will say that. A true person in classical education will say, this is a tool to help you. They start off with what they call the trivium, the big three. And again, it's not that they're neglecting the others. These are the foundational components for it, which the trivium is considered the tools for language. Because like you mentioned, going with how our brain works, some of the first things infants learn are language skills and trying to imitate. Well, that's huge. They need to know language. They need to be able to read and to write. They need to know how to communicate. So it is getting to those traditional basics of what they call grammar, which, yes, you might have the subjects and verbs and pronouns, but that's not what they're referring to with grammar. Their view of grammar is more of the oral or the direct learning of that, teaching them to be able to read, your phonics, getting those sounds. It does involve Latin. Sometimes they will even include Greek. When I was I taught high school English for over 20 years in public school, Christian school, and a charter school. So I've been in a lot of different settings. And I remember walking into a new school that I was going in to teach, and they had several different workbooks and things to help with vocabulary. And one of them was nothing but Latin root words, Latin prefixes and suffixes, and then they had one on Greek root words, because that is so much of the basis of words we use. And so once they realized, oh, I know what that prefix means, I may not know the whole word, but I can begin to figure out parts of it. And we all know that if you begin teaching them when they're very small, they pick it up so much faster than someone my age trying to learn Greek and Latin now, because I don't know it. I wish I did. It would make all the studies I'm doing so much easier. But it also includes writing. It is a whole person view. They include gymnastics, not the Olympic gymnastics, but physical education. They want the whole body, because if we can bring our body under control, it can help us do everything under control. Scripture talks about that. They look at math and science, even though it's not as emphasized with the STEM. And if, for those of you not familiar, STEM is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And that is a huge push right now of, we need to increase in public education the STEM schools. And some of them will add STEAM because they discovered you can't get away from the arts. So they add the A in there to put the arts back in. So the trivium is the basic of it. Caldecott said grammar, what they call grammar in the trivium, is the knowledge of how to speak without error. So we can see that as we work with little children. Years ago, we helped run a children's home in South Carolina. And one of our children came in, 2 years old. And like typical children, you know, we're sitting there, we were eating, and he looked up at me and he said, "Me love pizza." And automatically I said, "I love pizza?" You know, trying to emphasize the correct way to say it. And he's like, "Oh, me too, me too." He just, right over his head. But we need to work with young people, and what is the correct way to speak? Because if you listen to people, it is not that way. There are many times I cringe when I hear different conversations. And I know, I'll tell students sometimes, yes, there is a text conversation, but there's also a formal conversation that you need to know when you go in and apply for a job. They're not the same. So we need to, they need to know this. There is a huge form of imitation of getting them to, from phonics to imitating good storytelling, good structure. How do they get that? Through quality materials. And as a Christian, the Bible is our first one. Knowing those Bible stories. But we can also use the classics. We can read, even if they're simpler versions of classical stories, even the mythology is not all bad, because we can show them and build character. What did this person do that was good? What did they do was bad? What does God say about that? Especially in a Christian setting. But even in the public school setting, we can talk about character building, because character education is still there. We might not be able to use the Bible necessarily as truth for them, but we can refer to it. The second part of it in the trivium is what they call the dialectic or logic. I think of dialogue, conversations, like we've been doing, sharing. But teaching them how to ask questions and then even how to respond. One of the big things in both my master's and my doctoral program have been discussions, discussion posts. We have to read so many pages a week. We have to submit questions based on what we've read. And then our professor selects some of those, and those become our discussions. Sometimes we don't know until the morning of what we're going to discuss, but he has expected us to have read the material to be able to draw on it and discuss it. And what do we think about this? Or what do you think this means? I tried to do something like that with some of my college students. They don't always know how to ask questions, whether interpretive or syntopical. They don't know what to pull out or how do I, you know. So that is a teaching moment of getting them, okay, let's read this. What are some questions we need to ask? Especially in getting them to think as teachers, what are questions you would need to write for your students to either answer or do on a test? Because if you don't know the key points, they're not going to know them either. So learning to have a conversation, getting that clear argument, learning to separate true from false. A lot of judgment in there, a lot of conversations, reasoning, seeing connections between subjects. The last part of the trivium is rhetoric, which is their speaking. We can read something, we can think about it. Now how do I share it? And again, this is at different levels throughout the grades. A first grader asking questions about a story and standing up and telling you what he thinks is a little bit different than a senior in high school. But they all can do it. Children love to tell you what they think, or what they, you know, to tell about a story or answer questions about it. That's important, teaching them how. Now, yes, the skills increase as they go up, but that is all part of it. The second part of classical education, you got the trivium, which is the basics. The quadrivium, four more subjects they add. And these deal more with science, that once we get the communication part, the reading and the writing, the reasoning, understanding, we can expand on that. Now, they don't neglect all the parts. Like I said, it's mixed throughout, but this is the one that as they learn to read and as they learn to write, then you're able to go deeper, just like in our subjects. We don't throw everything at them as first graders. The quadrivium really does work more with arithmetic. We've got the numbers, we know the basics, we know how to add and to subtract. Now they're getting more into reasoning about numbers. That's where you would get into the deduction of geometry, seeing the definitions and the assumptions and how do they prove this. They usually think about astronomy. And we're like, astronomy? We don't learn about astronomy in school. Well, we learn about time. We teach children how to tell time. And it used to be done through the sun and the stars. Navigation, engineering, finding the sense of history and place. All of that basically comes from the natural sciences, which is what they viewed. You know, Psalms 19 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands." Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they display knowledge. So using God's handiwork to get them to thinking and understanding, it just increases it. Music is a huge part of it. We know young people learn rhymes and music to even learn things. We increase that of learning about different instruments, learning the theory of music, the vocal parts of it, harmonies. There's a lot of math in music. But it's not just music. You got all the fine arts, the poetry, drama, artwork, architecture, all of that looks at beauty and even eloquence, which are huge components of what we want them to understand. So that's kind of a quick overview of what is classical education and all the different components. From some of you that are involved in it, teach it, or have had children in it, is there something I have not included that to you stands out to help us better understand what is classical education?
Mm-hmm. Based on Dorothy Sayers' Lost Tools of Learning, mm-hmm. Basically our K through 6 is the grammar stage, mm-hmm. our 7 and 8 is our dialectic stage, and our high school is our rhetoric stage, and they're active in, they have a specific rhetoric class each year as well, where they mm-hmm. actually debate in class and these sorts of things too. And mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so basically it's dates and dead people and all that in the grammar stage. Of course you talk about grammar being language, your math facts are grammar, your anything that's just memorization of history or memorization of poems or memorization of songs, anything memorization is grammar.
Yes. Grammar is your more basics, getting us started on all of that.
So you have all of that in your background. Mm-hmm. You already have that there.
Yes, the different stages, and they are, if you look at most, what I would say, full-scale classical programs, they are divided up by grades. But I also know that when I'm reading, even to my grandkids, I have one granddaughter who is 4 and one who is one, a grandson who's 1.5, if I'm reading a story to them, especially as they get a little bit older, when I'm reading to kindergartners, you're asking them questions. You know, even now with the 1.5-year-old, as I'm reading a book, I'll ask, "Do you see the dog? Where's the dog? Can you point to it?" Now, yes, those are not necessarily what we would think of high-level reasoning skills, but it is. He's having to think and find it. Can he recognize it? So there are levels of it throughout. And like I said, these are tools. I'm not going to stand up here and say, you need to go home and start doing 100% classical education. Now, I love it, but I do think there are elements that we can do in all forms of education, regardless of what we're in. And some of it we probably already do and just didn't know that's what it is. But yes, there is a huge component in the grammar section of drilling. I think of Abeka. My girls did Abeka in elementary school, and they emphasize drilling those sounds, apple, and they go through and do the sounds and phonics. then you had the math drills where you learned the addition facts, and then we learned the multiplication tables. That's not just a Becca. That was the way it was when I was in school. I went to a public elementary school, and I can remember in third grade was when we had to learn multiplication tables, and I was terrified of my teacher because even though I was a good student and I had learned the multiplication tables, she drew a big circle and mixed up the numbers like it was a clock, but she had put them in different order, and she'd say, okay, we're going to do the 2 times table today. You're going to come up with the ruler, and you're going to point to and say 2 times whatever the number is, and tell me the answer within so many seconds. And for everyone you miss, you get a lick with the paddle. And I'm like, ooh! You talk about fear and wanting to forget everything you knew. I was terrified. And it, not just for me, for all my other friends that I knew were struggling. I was like, oh, don't hit them, don't hit them. It was terrible. That's not classical education. But the drilling of it and the going over it to help them know, because if they know it foundationally, neurologically, if we learn it, our brain doesn't have to necessarily think about that. We're able to think about other things later. You're able to expand and go on. It becomes what they call rote memory. We just know 2 plus 2 is 4. I didn't have to stop and think or count. And that's the goal. What do we want out of education? We talk about all the different things from STEM to classical to traditional to all the new things going on now. A big thing right now is scripted education. What do we want out of it? You mentioned a while ago that classical is not really focused on vocations. Well, there is a thing of vocational education. What is it that we want? What do we want for our children or our grandchildren? So brainstorm with me. When you think of, okay, this person is educated. What do I expect that to mean? That this person is educated. How do I know that this is an educated person?
I want them to think.
Okay? To be able to think. All right. All right. To understand so that they can act on that understanding.
And articulate it.
Talk to me. Tell me. Yes.
To test.
Today, that's a big thing, testing.
Mm-hmm. Last year they read Robinson Crusoe and those type books, 8 to 10 of those a year is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I wanted to do was be able to have class discussions, biblical comparisons, all those kind of things in class, and if they're bogged down with just reading.
Yes.
There's other places they could learn to read. We were being able to critique the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I was telling our board was, I said this kind of stuff applies not only to literature that we're reading in this class, but it applies to the Disney show that they watched on Disney Plus. It applies to the YouTube video or the Facebook thing that they saw.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of reasoning skill carries over into every area of life. And you're not just taking what they give you, which is what we felt the school system seemed to be doing, is this is what you do,
mm-hmm.
and this is how you do it.
Right. We're not prescripting. We want them to think about it.
Now, that can be a faster way if your ultimate goal is, I've got to be able to say that by 10th grade, my kid is an engineer.
Yes.
When it's one of the things that Dorothy Sayers was critical of.
Mm-hmm. Using the audiobooks, like he said, we do want them to be able to read, but if we're bogged down in understanding, that is a common method, or I have even in high school classes, especially lower level ones, read portions to them when we were reading Shakespeare or parts of the Odyssey, because they do struggle And I would find shorter things. I would make them read them aloud. They hated it until they got to pick their friend to be the next person to read. But when we came to a section that I knew was rough or was key or was extra long, I did it. And there were many times they were like, "Are you going to read to us today?" That's also, I have recently seen some articles on using classical education with mild to moderate special needs children. And they were talking about different accommodations, including using audiobooks. But they were looking at how that repetition and the drills of the grammar were very beneficial to especially children with dyslexia or other mild issues, that they saw that. And then when they got into the part where they could talk and discuss and the rhetoric of defending, they came alive because they were able to speak and share their thoughts so much easier than they could even to write them down. And so it really has, it's interesting to see that study that is beginning, even to see how that can help with children of special needs. So when we typically think of education and what we want out of it, Christopher Perrin, who wrote an introduction to classical education, he put, classical education seeks to restore not only the authoritative, which is often removed today, that there is no authority, traditional and enduring form or education, but it also reaffirms the biblical mandates of parental involvement in training children. Like you said, having the parents help read or having them use the audiobooks, that we don't neglect the parents, we need the parents. They help drill, they help, and that's hard, especially in public school. Well, it's hard in any school. You get that because parents are busy. But helping them see that we need you to talk with your child. We need you to read with your child. We want you to. You are the primary, God's holding the family responsible for the biblical instruction of your child. We want to assist with that, but we're not to take the place of you. Another one comes from St. Augustine. True wisdom comprises at least two significant components: a thorough reading of Scripture and general knowledge of its content, knowing the background of the Bible, and then to learn everything else. That's that liberal part, the liberal arts of, yes, we need to have a good general knowledge of what's out there. Mortimer Adler and Robert Hutchins put together what they call the Great Books of Western Civilization. It is put out by Encyclopedia Britannica. There are currently 64 volumes, and they're like big encyclopedias with a fine little print. But basically, it's a compilation of all what they consider the classic authors. You've got the writings of Sir Isaac Newton. You've got the writings of Plato. You've got Socrates. You've got Galileo. You've even got more modern ones. They have some of the literary greats in there. But a huge scope. And they will tell you these are not the only good books or great books to read. And they will often even list others they recommend. But he said the objectives of his program of putting that together was to develop basic intellectual skills. Skills of critical reading, attentive listening, precise speech, and above all, reflective thought. Only through reading and discussing books that are over one's head can the skills of critical reading and reflective thought be developed. And when I first read that, I thought, wait a minute. Read over our head? I know what it's like in this doctoral program when I'm reading something, I'm like, I have read this same sentence four times, I have no idea what it's talking about. And I want to do that to young people. Don't we do it anyway? When I am reading to my grandchildren, those stories are over their heads. They, even to read a Bible story to them, they don't understand all of that yet. Now they're learning and they are picking up, they're not even speaking right now. They're not saying a sentence, and I am reading sentences to them. But that's how they learn. Why should it be different in reading something more complex? And what is interesting is when they finally get through it and they start talking and discussing it, of how excited they get when they're like, I was right, this, I did understand it. I pulled excerpts. I don't have time for my students, like you mentioned, all the number of novels they read, to read all of Plato's Republic. But I have before pulled out, even in high school English, sections of it, or sections of the Odyssey. Now, ideally, it would be great for them to do the whole thing so they could understand the background. But I pulled out, the most common one I use from Plato is the allegory of the cave. And I will print out that section, and I'll give them a little background of the context of where it's coming in his Republic and what the purpose that he had of putting it in there. But then I have them read it. Again, a lot of times we'll read it out loud together, even though it's still long. And then I have them talk about it. What is the meaning just as he's saying? What's going on? Tell me, if we had to do a plot line, what's happening here? And then we go deeper. Why do you think he said that? What is he talking about? And then we look at it scripturally even. How does this relate to us as Christians sharing the gospel? What is this saying? Or for my teacher education students, what does this say about us teaching? What does this imply? And just getting them, and they start discussing, and they get so excited that they're able to relate to this and see how it connects to so many different parts of life. I think that's what he's talking about, that we don't shy away from something that's difficult, but we use it to get that interest in learning and get them excited and knowing about it. It also gives us that common base, again, that foundation of things to talk about. And that is difficult now because many people don't know the classics anymore. You know, that used to be you could mention something about Plato and even the allegory of the cave and everybody's like, oh, I know what you're talking about. And today they're like, yeah, I've heard of Plato. Have no idea what you're talking about with the cave. But there's not that basics. And even worse, there is so much biblical illiteracy now that they don't understand those connections either. In one of my last public high school classes that I taught, we were reading a novel, and it described something as being that character's Garden of Eden. And I remember the person had read it, and we had talked about, you know, what was going on in the story, and I said, well, why did they call it that? What does that mean? Silence. Have you ever heard the term Garden of Eden? I finally had one person say, isn't it something from the Bible? One out of 32 students had heard of it. So we don't have that background anymore. And there's so much they miss that they don't understand. So for us, when we're seeing about developing students who are having this common base of knowledge, they're able to communicate. Now, it's not to know all the trivia. It's not to go win Jeopardy. That's not what I'm talking about of the common base of knowledge. It's more to have them, I would call it being a person of excellence, a well-rounded person, able to do and function in whatever God calls them to do. So for the Christian, why it's important. Abraham Lincoln even said, the philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation becomes the philosophy of the government in the next. And we see that as it changes, of how things that they do in class and learn and question, you remove truth, you remove biblical knowledge. Well, we're so far from that now. You're seeing how it impacts and it changes. So we want to cultivate excellence. going back to Christopher Perrin, he said every moral choice has a rationale behind it, whether good or ill. Our schools should be a laboratory dedicated to content analysis of choice that either demonstrate godliness or expose hypocrisy. Again, helping them find truth and figure out what's false. That's the basic that we use as Christians with the traditional or classical education, getting them to know how to study, how to discuss, how to question, how to debate, how to practice, develop habits. And ultimately, for a Christian, we want them to be able to prevent being deceived by false teaching. And that's where we can guide them, even though we're wanting them to question and discuss, it goes back to the authority, that we're able to guide them and say, okay, that is one thought, and you're right, a lot of people have said that. What does the Bible say? And let's pull that in and bring that to them to help them know. One way they do this is through stories. Literature is huge. Reading is huge. And they go back to those, what I call primary documents. They look back at some of the first things about what is history. Having to read that of what somebody said history was very interesting. But they do it to show actions have consequences. When you're reading a story, what happened? Did the good guy win? Did the bad guy win? Was it a good guy, but he just made some bad choices? And what does this show? Especially when we're looking at moral values as they are today. I was finishing a paper last night for a class I've been taking, and in this particular book I was reading, it talked about the different views of justice. And you had a liberationist view, you had a liberal political view, you had the feminist view, you had a libertarian's view, and then you had a virtue ethicist view. And trying to compare, and they would all argue back and forth in the book of, well, you said this and you said this. But in reading, I'm taking notes as I'm going through in my book or highlighting, okay, I can agree with that. This one is totally off the mark. There was one of them that said, yes, but the Bible says, and so this is what we're emphasizing, and I'm putting, that's not what the Bible says. I even wrote a reference. Genesis says this. And we want our students to be able to do that. We want our young people to be able to do that, not to take it at face value, but to read it and see, okay, that I don't agree with. And we want them to do it very well. I remember one thing in the book that stood out to me. The liberationist said, I know that much of the Christian viewpoint is for us to have people of excellence, to have people do their best. We have this great work ethic. And as a liberationist, we are against that. It is not, it can be virtuous to be lazy, because that is going against the status quo and going, I mean, it was just craziness. But I thought, here are people teaching our young people, you don't have to do your best. Just get by, or do the opposite. Reject this. No wonder. I mean, and that's what this is emphasizing. We've got to get back to teaching them, yes, you do want to do your best. Whatever your best is, doesn't have to match somebody else's best. What can you do? And as a Christian, what does God want you to do? You know, He calls us to try to be excellent, to be in His image, and He's perfect. Roman teacher Quintilian said, my aim is the education of a perfect orator. The first essential for such a one is that he should be a good man. And consequently, we demand of him not merely possession of exceptional gifts of speech, but all excellences as well. That well-rounded person to be excellent in whatever they see before them. So what now? What do we do? Incorporate it as much as we can. Get them to reading. Get them into these classics. Get them into the Bible, especially if we're in a Christian setting or a homeschool setting, that we could do that. But even, like I said, in the public school, when I asked, one of them said about the Garden of Eden, well, I think it's from the Bible. I told him, you're right. And I reached over and I pulled up my phone and pulled the passage where it described in Genesis, the Garden of Eden, and I read it to him. I said, that's what it's referring to. That is an illusion. And we talked about it, what an illusion was. So yes, you can read the Bible in public school. It was fitting in right with what we were doing. They need those foundational skills, foundational language skills. They need to read the Bible. They need to read classics. They need to discuss and find out. Discussions don't mean heated arguments. Like, debates you see on TV are typically not debates. They are just knocked down mudslinging. Yes, that is not a debate. We need to teach them how to be able to debate, how to disagree in love. They need to drill. They need to have questions. And we can choose those elements. Maybe you are not able to do a whole entire, like I said, Plato's Republic. You're not able to read that whole huge book. But we can choose parts of it. And if you're not familiar with it, Google is wonderful and has enough of those. And the other great thing is, you're like, well, even if I were to add these in my school setting or at home, I can't afford all these books because they're classics. Most of them are free online
and PDF
forms that can be printed. And there are some out there that are even done in children's versions. Yes, there's material out there, but just to start it, teach them how to, I call it annotate, how to make notes. It's not highlighting every single thing on the in the paragraph. That doesn't help you. So deciding and figuring out what are we able to do, get them discussing. Those are critical. So with you, what are some ways that either you implement or do it, or something that you've seen really works that you would say, this is what, if we were to leave today, I want other people to know they could do with classical education and how it could make a difference in us developing the well-rounded person for Christ?
Read to your kids.
Read.
When COVID happened and all the children that were in public school came home, and then I became like a professional. The one who knew what, because I homeschool, I said, if you will read to your kids, read good books, not
yes,
but if you will read some good books to your kids, they will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
I promise. I don't think they listened, but I told them, I said, this is, if
right,
you will read to your kids and discuss what they're reading and what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
They will progress, and they will be okay.
Reading, discussing, even making applications to what's going on, those connections. And they come up with some interesting ones, too. Sometimes they think of things that we don't think about, and it's like, well, you're right. That is true.
It sounds intimidating. A lot of the things that we, one of the main things we learned when we first started homeschooling was that don't be afraid to learn and teach right. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're learning the week before your kid is learning in your homeschooling.
Mm-hmm. You're trying to stay a lesson ahead. Yes.
But
real life.
I think it applies into this, right? If you start incorporating portions of this or a model of this into your framework of what you're doing, understand and be patient with the fact that you're learning too, and that you're passing that down, and don't be discouraged by that. It is wonky at first.
Mm-hmm. It is different. It does. It is a work in progress.
And don't underestimate your kids' ability to take some of it.
Yes. Children are able to do and understand a lot more than we think sometimes. Yes?
I'm a first-year college composition instructor, and I see a huge gap between senior year and freshman in college and how they reason, how they provide evidence, how they write their papers. And the one major thing is we have open discussion, like you said, because that helps their mind get in full gear. And I've seen that by the end, the learning outcome, their mind maps are strengthened, and they have verbalized that their mind maps have strengthened. And all we do, there's an example that we use in the animal rights. We go from like the 17th century and we go forward, and they have a hard time understanding that we're at a roundtable discussion, and the discussion continues. Like, there's no right or wrong. So when we emphasize, we're not trying to be right, we're just trying to carry on a discussion. Their minds are blown when they see, hey, we can talk about this, but we're not trying to, well, you're wrong and I'm right. It's just we're trying to move forward and progress based on this particular issue. And that really helps them move forward.
What you're talking about is being able to define the word argument as not a contest.
Yes, not a contest, not volatile.
It is a way of presenting data and thinking through the data accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And we may not agree on it. Yes.
Toward a conclusion that you still may agree to disagree, but.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Based on rhetoric and debate.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the Socratic method, yes. Yeah. Using Socrates, discussion. Yeah. It is. And it is beneficial because it helps you hear. You're learning to listen to other people. You're learning to think about what they say. Decide, do I agree with it or not? Why do I not agree with it? Can I back up? Like you say, learning for them to provide evidence. And talking through that is huge. It's almost time to go. Any other insights or questions? Because I am not the one who knows everything there is to know. That's why I love this discussion. Yes?
So, my first introduction to classical education, I have elementary students. So I was very put off by, at the grammar stage, it's a lot of that drilling, a lot of that memorization. And to me, it was like, look, memorization, that's the basis form of knowledge. Like, why are we having these students quote things that they don't even understand? But like my children, we were learning where they could locate things on the map, and they're like, I was like, they have no idea what Greece is other than Greece is right here. They have no idea what Antioch is other than Antioch is right here. But then as we were having devotions and we were talking about these places, it was like, hey, that's where this is.
Yes.
And then he went here. And so it's that well-rounded. So like when you are first starting, it might seem like they're not actually learning it. They're just
spouting it
back out. It's just that rote memory. And you kind of, at first, you feel like they're not understanding it. But as you continue in that grammar stage, the rhetoric will naturally come because we're about to enter our fourth year of doing it. And this last year, it was a whole lot more of, okay, I get it, but what, and so it's just, it's that natural outflow. So if you're first starting, you might have this, like, this is not doing anything, but it does. It's one of those that just kind of naturally progresses.
Great encouragement.
That's one of the things, what she's talking about, it's one of the things Dorothy Sayers mentioned in her paper, was that there's a stage in there right around the junior high stage where you start comparing yourself to other people and you think, oh, I'm behind. And what you realize is you're behind maybe for a year of what people would call where you're supposed to be. And but then all of a sudden you surpass.
Yeah, you're like, take off. Yes. Anyone else? Well, thank you for coming.